Welcome to TWIL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on March the 5th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the Francis King Carey School of Law at the University of Maryland.
And today we're very, very happy to welcome Abigail Moncrief, who's a professor of law at Boston University School of Law. She's an expert in health law, administrative law, and constitutional law, and she was the principal author of an amicus brief filed in the King and Burwell case. A great welcome to you, Abby.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so we're recording this conversation the day after the oral arguments in King. What a great idea that was. For the last few weeks, though it seems like months, we have been bombarded with statistics, projections, and so on about the fallout from this case, whichever way it goes. Everything from the end of the Affordable Care Act to the demise of the Roberts Court. So let's try and sort of start gently and sort of frame the legal issues for our listeners and frankly also for me. And then we'll talk a little bit about what happened in the courtroom yesterday. So I guess my first question is the issue in King one of standing, one of constitutional law, one of administrative law, or one of statutory interpretation?
So I think it's important to note at the outset that those things are all highly interrelated. But I will say that the case at its highest level is definitely an administrative law case. The question is whether the IRS rule interpreting the Affordable Care Act is a valid interpretation of the provisions it purports to be enforcing. So as an administrative law case, the question is fairly straightforward. Did the IRS properly or improperly interpret Section 36B of the Affordable Care Act when it decided that subsidies should be available on both state and federally run exchanges? Now, to answer that question, we have to know what the proper interpretation of Section 36B is, which means that we have to delve into statutory interpretation. And part of the reason for that is that Chevron deference, the doctrine that tells courts that they should defer to agency interpretations of the statutes they administer, contains a footnote, a very important footnote, that says that when deciding whether a statute is ambiguous, because ambiguity triggers deference, when deciding whether a statute is ambiguous, courts should resort to all traditional tools of statutory construction. So in order to decide whether the IRS rule should be upheld or not, the court has to decide whether the statute is ambiguous or not. And in deciding whether the statute is ambiguous or not, it has to engage in all of the usual practices of statutory interpretation that it would engage in even if there hadn't been an agency interpretation. So the case becomes a case of statutory interpretation. And then the question of where the Constitution fits in is that there is a canon of statutory construction, a canon of statutory construction that matters in applying all the traditional tools of statutory construction called the canon of constitutional avoidance, which says that if a statute could mean one or two things, one thing or another thing, and one of those things would render the statute unconstitutional, then the courts should choose the other one, should choose the one that avoids the constitutional difficulty, so that the courts don't have to engage themselves in passing on the difficult constitutional question that would otherwise be raised. So that canon raises a constitutional question about the statute, but doesn't put the constitutionality of the statute directly in jeopardy. So the case isn't a constitutional case no matter what, but if the court picks up on the argument that the plaintiff's interpretation of the statute in this case raises a constitutional question that could be avoided by deferring to the IRS, then that's a pretty powerful reason for the court to uphold the IRS's interpretation and reject the plaintiff's interpretation of the statute. Now, the standing question is difficult because that's both a constitutional requirement and a factual question. So it's difficult for the Supreme Court, which doesn't have the ability to investigate facts as a trial court does, but has to assure itself of its own jurisdiction to hear the case. So the Supreme Court has to worry about whether or not the plaintiffs have standing, because if they don't, the Supreme Court can't decide the case at all. But it's really hard for the Supreme Court as a high-level appellate court without discovery or cross-examination or any of those tools at its disposal to determine whether or not the plaintiffs actually do have standing. So I doubt the court is going to go in that direction in this case. The justices didn't seem particularly inclined to go that way, but they did ask questions along the lines of standing, and they do have a constitutional and jurisdictional obligation to assure themselves that the plaintiffs, or at least one plaintiff in the case, has standing to be there.
That was such a fantastic precis, Abby. I really appreciate that. And I mean, just on a side note, I mean, there was a recent article that Elizabeth Joe reviewed in Jotwell, which was all about the Supreme Court's difficulties in terms of making factual determinations or predictions about the consequences of what they would do, and failing. And that actually came up yesterday in the oral arguments, where I believe Justice Scalia said, well, you know, if we get rid of this, Congress will come in and fix it. There won't be chaos. And Donald Verrilli was just incredulous at that. I wanted to ask you a question about the nature of interpretation here. And just to lay out for our listeners the most hermeneutically charitable account of the challenger's claim here, which appears to be, the challengers seem to be saying that, the reason why out of the 400,000 words in the Affordable Care Act, in 26 U.S.C. Section 36B, Congress put in an exchange established by the state as opposed to within the state or for the state, was because Congress had this sort of an offer you can't refuse mentality, that they wanted to only allow people to get these premium assistance tax credits if states took ownership of these exchanges. And could you comment on the plausibility of that sort of threat theory of the case?
Sure. So, you know, I think on its face, that argument is not utterly implausible. It's not entirely implausible to imagine that some Congress somewhere might have decided that it would give subsidies to citizens only in the states that were willing to implement a federal policy. In fact, Congresses since the 1930s, since the New Deal, have done such things. They have offered money to states that's conditioned on the state's willingness to participate in or implement a federal policy prerogative. So that's not crazy to imagine that this statute might have been similar. Once you start looking at the rest of the statute, it becomes somewhat crazy, particularly given that the federal fallback option specified in Section 1321 of the statute has the title in it of state flexibility and seems to really be driving at an either-or option for the states of set up an exchange or don't, we'll do it for you, and creates other incentives that are just as meaningful for the states. Well, they're not as big, but they are incentives that are there for the states to implement the federal policy. It's not clear that this hugely draconian threat that the petitioners are imagining of withdrawing subsidies was actually intended. In fact, it's pretty clear that to me that it wasn't when you look at the rest of the statute. But because it's not a crazy theory of some Congress's plausible intent, the Supreme Court decided to take it seriously. Now, this is a big shift in the interpretive methodology of the Supreme Court of the United States, and I think you sort of alluded to that at the opening of that question, because for a long time before textualism rose as an interpretive theory, in the 1970s and 80s, courts would care about what the actual enacting Congress actually intended, what their purpose was in writing the statute, and what they actually thought they were saying when they wrote the words of a statute. This court doesn't seem to care about that. They don't seem to care about the actual intent of the enacting Congress. What they care about is whether the words on the page could potentially mean, whether some rational Congress might have meant what the words on the page seem to require. which in this case, taking a sort of very simplistic reading of the three words by the state in Section 36B, requires one to read into the provision this big threat of establish an exchange or you don't get subsidies for your citizens.
That does make a lot of sense as a, you know, a contrast in terms of if you are a strict textualist or not. Although we can get into the methodologies of textualism, purposivism, original or other forms of statutory interpretation. One thing that I wanted to mention as well that your discussion of interpretive methodology brings up for me is a contrast with a case like FDA versus Brown and Williamson, which I teach for my administrative law class, which came down to the question of whether extant FDA law allowed the FDA to regulate tobacco as a drug. And you saw there in Justice O'Connor's opinion for the court, not merely looking at the whole statute involved, but at a range of statutes and other congressional purposes, and, you know, putting together like a very complex, rich tapestry of analysis about what was actually going on there. And ironically enough, you had on the other side Justice Breyer, who sort of was saying, well, if it affects the structure or function of the body, it can be regulated. So it is just interesting to note how the methodological approaches can flip-flop depending on the who's involved and whose ox is being gored.
That's absolutely right. And it's one thing that I teach legislation, which is at a 1L course at BU. And it's a course that's focused almost entirely on statutory interpretation. And to some extent, the students absolutely despise this course because there is no law. So the justices will do kind of whatever they want with a statutory case without following the interpretive methodology that they followed in the case they decided yesterday. And we see the same thing happening in this case where lots of people made a big deal out of Justice Kagan's opinion in Yates, a case about whether fish constitute tangible objects within the meaning of a criminal statute, which came down a few days ago. And they looked at that and said, well, Justice Kagan wrote a pretty textualist opinion saying that fish are tangible objects because, well, duh, fish are tangible and they're objects. And she didn't join the more intentionalist, purposivist opinion that Justice Ginsburg wrote. And so people thought, well, maybe she'll be textualist in King. But then her questioning in the King oral arguments makes it seem like probably not, or maybe she's thinking that that textualism actually justifies upholding the IRS rule when you look at the whole statute or something along those lines. But when we talk about interpretive methodologies, we can think about which arguments do and don't fit into particular interpretive methodologies and which interpretive methodologies cut in which directions for particular cases. But it's very hard to layer those interpretive methodologies or arguments onto justices because the justices don't seem to be principled at all about which interpretive methodology they're going to follow. And so I think the Brown and Williamson case is an ideal example of that because it was authored by Justice O'Connor, who was more inclined towards purposivism and other kinds of more relaxed readings of statutory language. But it was joined by Justice Scalia, who claims to be a strict textualist. And there's just no way that the same Justice Scalia, who is saying that state can't mean federal, that's gobbledygook in the King oral arguments, could also think that drug can't mean tobacco. It seems perfectly obvious to a principled textualist that, of course, tobacco is any substance other than food intended to affect the structure or any function of the human body, which is the definition of drug in the statute they were interpreting. So there's no particularly good way to use the high-minded debates about interpretation to predict outcomes in cases or votes of individual justices, but they are interesting things to think about in terms of the arguments that are going to succeed and not.
I've enjoyed, listening to Nick Bagley and Jonathan Adler debate the King issue or the what they viewed was the central King issue, which seems with respect to be a lot of sort of chasing of little references and finding as many of them throughout the Affordable Care Act that sort of supports one interpretation or the other. And I wonder whether this court is particularly interested in that chase. Certainly the questions that I saw recorded from yesterday didn't seem to show particular interest in it. And I wonder what your opinion was on that, Abby.
Yeah, I agree. I think my reading of what the justices were concerned about primarily was tracking more or less a difference between purposivism and textualism. The justices were sort of dividing along lines of, well, we have to give effect to the three words by the state. And if that creates a crazy statute, then that creates a crazy statute. It's our job to enforce the words of the statute. And the words of the statute say by the state, which means that we have to limit the subsidies to exchanges established by the state, not by HHS. So that was the Scalia-Alito take on things. And then the liberal justices didn't seem particularly interested in finding all of the various anomalies that would arise in the statute from giving effect to those three words. They seem more interested in saying, no, this just creates a crazy statute, and we shouldn't imagine that Congress intended to write a crazy statute. And then Justice Kennedy picked up on the unconstitutionality of the threat embodied in the petitioner's interpretation, which is actually a little bit different than the threat we were talking about earlier. It's not just the threat of taking away subsidies. It's the threat of intentional regulatory destruction of the individual insurance markets in the states that fail to establish exchanges. Both Sotomayor and Kennedy were interested in that argument, and both made it clear that they were following it along as the difficulties associated with a regulatory threat rather than the potential difficulties associated with the financial threat. So the divisions among the court didn't seem to follow along the Bagley-Adler canon line of debate about, you know, oh, the statute says by the state here and there and this other place, and then it has this definition of qualified individual here and the reporting requirement there, and, you know, the reporting requirement says makes a specific reference to exchanges established under Section 1321. Doesn't that show Congress knew how to do that? Da, 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 da. They talked about those things, but those things didn't seem to be deciders for any of the justices.
So the Solicitor General didn't seem particularly keen to embrace the sort of coercion argument. Instead, he sort of replied in answer to a question, well, that's sort of a novel issue. And I wondered what the story was there.
Well, he said it explicitly in his answer, and it was Justice Alito who asked him the question, which I found interesting. But I think Justice Alito was probably hoping that Verrilli was going to say, no, I don't think it's coercive. But Verrilli answered the question in a strategic way where he said, well, I can't stand up here and tell you that I think the statute would be unconstitutional if the petitioners won, because I'm going to have to get up here in the constitutional challenge and argue the opposite. So if the statute is challenged on those grounds, it will be my job to defend it. And if it comes to that, I will defend it on the authority of New York against the United States. But this does seem to be a really difficult, novel question, and I think there's a compelling case for applying the avoidance canon here for that reason. So he answered it kind of in the best way I could have hoped for as the person who really put forward this argument in the amicus brief, so that he kept the argument alive but didn't commit himself to an understanding that this would be unconstitutional.
Yes, and that amicus brief, if you could go into a little bit of background for our audience, just recounting your role in that and how that came about. I think that I saw the story about how Justice Kennedy seemed very influenced by the arguments in that, and I was wondering if you could tell the story of your involvement.
Sure. So it actually all began in a seminar I was teaching called Healthcare Reform and the Constitution. We were talking about this case. And one of my students brought up, well, you know, if the statute really intends to prevent subsidies from flowing in states that don't set up their own exchanges, couldn't that be unconstitutionally coercive under the Supreme Court's Medicaid holding in NFIB, in the first Obamacare case? And I thought, wow, yeah, you know, you're right. There's at least a small constitutional difficulty there. They should use the avoidance canon. And the more I thought about it and the more I looked into it, the more I thought, wow, this is actually, there's a really big constitutional problem here. It's not just the issue of potentially taking subsidies away from citizens. It's also this bizarre mix of regulations that will apply in the states that don't set up their own exchanges, where all of the market reforms, guaranteed issue, community rating, the minimum medical loss ratio, et cetera, all of those regulations will apply, but the individual mandate will no longer be in effect with respect to most purchasers in the individual market, and the employer mandate won't be in effect at all because the employer mandate is 100% contingent on an employee receiving subsidies, receiving federal subsidies. So that mix of regulations, which the federal government will enforce in states that fail to set up exchanges, seems perfectly designed to create insurance market death spirals and to destroy the individual insurance market in the states that refuse to comply. That's a much bigger threat than just you're going to miss out on $2 billion of subsidies. $2 billion of subsidies is a big threat, but we're going to intentionally destroy the market, the individual insurance market in your state is a much bigger threat. And it's a threat that's different in kind. It's not a fiscal threat, it's a regulatory threat, which raises two constitutional problems. One, the anti-coercion constraint in NFIB with a different twist on it because it's a regulatory rather than a fiscal threat. And two, there's another constitutional problem that the court didn't seem particularly inclined to pick up on, which is that if the federal government is treating different states differently through substantive regulatory law, then that raises a problem under Shelby County, which was the case in 2013 that invalidated certain provisions of the Voting Rights Act. And in that case, Chief Justice Roberts wrote that the Constitution contains a fundamental principle of equal sovereignty, requiring the federal government to treat all states the same. So the more I thought about this, the more convinced I became that this was a very, very big problem with the petitioner's interpretation, and that somebody needed to argue it, because I knew and, you know, had talked to lots of people who agreed that the Solicitor General would not be in a position to make this argument because he does need to think about whether his office will be able to defend the statute against a constitutional attack in the future. So they wouldn't be well positioned to make this argument in a full-throated way. And they also needed to focus their efforts on the pure statutory argument. So I thought, man, we need to do an amicus brief on this. And so I went to a group that I had worked with in the first Obamacare case, the Jewish Alliance for Law and Social Action, and asked if they would be interested in sponsoring a brief, and whether they would be willing to officially supervise my work, since I don't have a license and couldn't file with the Supreme Court. And they were very excited about it, so we got started, and I spent basically my entire Christmas break writing and rewriting and engaging the arguments with lots of commentators, getting lots of fantastic feedback from a lot of really great colleagues and from the student who was initially responsible for flagging this argument for me. And we got it filed, and it seems to have made a difference. So it's pretty exciting.
Well, that is just such a great story and very inspiring, I think, for a lot of us out here who are, you know, watch these from afar and occasionally have good ideas but wonder about, you know, should we try to advance them? And congratulations, because that is a wonderful view of the statute. And it brings to mind two items to me. One, your point about, you know, the Fed's still going ahead with enforcing all of the market reforms or market regulation without the balance of the premium assistance tax credit to buoy the exchanges. It reminds me actually of the dissent in NFIB versus Sebelius and a perhaps prophetic aspect of that dissent, which talked about severability, I believe, and said that, you know, well, this is the statute is like a finely tuned watch where you take one little spring out and the whole thing could just fall apart. And I think that's something that a lot of us are going to need to be thinking deeply about as there's selective enforcement of the ACA, such as, you know, the abandonment of the class provisions or other things like that. The other side of it, too, that I wanted to mention in terms of, you know, the effects and thinking about the effects of a particular decision by the court, either in terms of the canon of avoidance or what it will result in, is Jack Balkin had a great post yesterday saying essentially, you know, there some of the Supreme Court justices just have a different version of how events will unfold, and constitutional law has not really theorized that well. But then on a more humorous note, I wanted to note Sarah Cliff's article, which we'll put on the show page, does a genealogy of arguments and discusses the 2010 conference at the American Enterprise Institute where a guy named Tom Christina was the first person to come up with this argument and presenting it in a slide that sort of motivated all of King v. Burwell. And what was so funny was on the same panel, there was another professor who stated the following, and I think we should think about this quote in thinking about the overall context of the litigation. He said, the ACA, and now I'm quoting, has to be killed as a matter of political hygiene. I do not care how this is done, whether it's dismembered, whether we drive a stake through its heart, whether we tar and feather it and drive it out of town, or if we strangle it. I don't care who does it, whether it's some court someplace or the United States Congress. Any which way, any dollar spent on that goal is worth spending. End quote. And it is an interesting glimpse into the reasoned discourse at the AEI and other places on the statute that was sort of in the water then and, you know, has gone from being what Jack Balkin would call off the wall to being on the wall at this point. And it's just great to see your work and sort of trying to reground some of the discussions in some of the larger principles here. So I really appreciate that.
Well, I kind of wanted to say thank you for the, you know, thank you so much for the reaction to the work. It's really gratifying to have it, you know, be recognized and appreciated. It certainly validates the many hours of effort put into it. But I do think, you know, I mean, this litigation and the original litigation and all of the other litigation that's going on against the ACA that's getting less attention and Hobby Lobby and all of it is all coming from the same place of a desire to destroy a statute after a political loss. That's not unique to major statutory reform, of course. You know, Social Security Act and the Medicare Act have both had several trips to the Supreme Court, and the Social Security Act had several trips immediately after its passage, you know, by political opponents. So the fact that these lawsuits are politically motivated doesn't surprise me at all, and the fact that they keep coming doesn't surprise me at all. What does surprise me a little bit is how much traction they get and how far they manage to go. This Supreme Court has been inclined to lend credence to arguments that seemed like they shouldn't have much credence lent to them when considering this statute, and that to me is a little bit interesting, but again, not particularly unusual. You know, if you think about the New Deal Court and its willingness to invalidate major legislation at that time.
I had a point going on from that, Abby. There was a feeling, I think, at the time of the first case before the court, the NFIB case, that perhaps the folks arguing the case, at least from the government side, didn't do a very good job of explaining the healthcare and health law issues in the case. I think that sort of tracks to an extent as well your point about sort of underestimating some of the leanings with regard to what looked like relatively weak arguments that we thought originally were raised in that case. Do you think things are better this time around, not just because of your work, but from looking at the work in the other briefs, that the issues were cleaner and clearer? I noticed, for example, that both Justice Kagan and Sotomayor took a quick swing at the mouse hole argument and the dysfunctional reform model. Someone clearly read your brief in the Kennedy chambers. So I just wonder what your overall sense was this time as to how the case had been argued and so on.
Yeah, so I mean, I think in this case they clearly read the Amici, several of them. They're the state's brief with the Pennhurst argument, the elephants and mouse holes argument that you mentioned. That came up in the oral arguments. The brief filed by several law professors, including Tom Merrill and Nick Bagley, and Jillian Metzger, and I'm forgetting now the other folks who were on it, but their brief on Bond and the presumption against altering the federal state balance also got mentioned at the court. So lots of input from Amici did make it into the oral arguments, which is a plus when the court is dealing with really complicated questions that impact a complicated industry. But I will say that I think that part of the reason that this case is going better is that the question of whether the state or federal government sets up an exchange and who gets subsidies and questions of tax law are more purely legal and somewhat more comfortable for the Supreme Court. Not that they get all of that stuff right all the time. In fact, they mess it up a lot. But it's a little bit easier than the really deep questions of what is health insurance that were confronting the court in the first Obamacare case in NFIB. So that question of, you know, what is health insurance? Is it just ordinary insurance? Is it a commodity? Is it social insurance? Is it a contract? How do we treat it? Is it a public utility? And that mattered to what kind of regulation the individual mandate is, whether it's a commercial regulation or not. And the Supreme Court was, and the government were sort of understandably doing a poor job of figuring out what it was exactly that they were talking about in that case, because these are actually really complicated, difficult questions that even we health law professors have a hard time trying to figure out and have a hard time coming to agreement on. So I think this case is of a different character than the first case, and I think that's part of why the Supreme Court and the government and the petitioners too have done a kind of more respectable job of really disentangling the legal questions.
Do you think that Justice Scalia's a question, why can't Congress just fix this, was a bit of a throwback to the last case rather than the depth of inquiry that you just detailed about this one? And while I'm on that topic, do you think he expected the quick riposte from the Solicitor General, quote, this Congress?
I don't know whether he expected it or not. If he didn't, he's kind of silly not to. But in some ways, Verrilli's reaction is a non sequitur for Scalia. Because what Scalia is really trying to get at there is not, this Congress will fix it, don't worry. He's not trying to reassure anybody that there's not going to be a problem, I don't think. I think what he's trying to say is, we are justices who are not politically accountable. We have life tenure and undiminished salary. What we really ought to do is just read and enforce Congress's words, not try to read and enforce its mind. And if Congress doesn't like the results, it should be responsible for fixing it. That's the job of the political branches, not the job of the judiciary. So I think Scalia is pursuing a somewhat, you know, high-minded theory of what the role of the court is in a regulatory state, more than he's, you know, trolling Verrilli for a snarky reply. But I think Verrilli's reply, you know, is the more realistic one, the one that most people watching the arguments actually care about, which is, if the justices do enforce the words and refuse to acknowledge that those words probably weren't meant to have the consequences that petitioners assigned to them, then the consequences really will be severe, and they will be severe for probably a pretty long time, because it's not clear that that anybody but Congress has the ability to fix the problem, and it's certainly clear that this particular Congress won't fix the problem.
That is a really helpful background and very balanced approach to the issue. And, you know, as someone that teaches administrative law and, you know, goes through the whole Scalia oeuvre, you know, over time, it is very interesting to think about, you know, where does the author of, say, the Tanner lectures, the scholar, end, and the more politically aware justice who, you know, let's face it, as Jeremy Waldron points out, you know, our Supreme Court is not a purely judicial institution. It's the one court that can sort of change its mind, can go over, you know, over time, and given its political identity, that's going to be an inevitable aspect of any justice's identity. So I really appreciate that that appreciation of both sides of his character and of his participation in this case. overall, I mean, any parting thoughts, final perspective here on the role, either the long term, you know, long durée sort of a role of the Supreme Court in influencing health policy, or the shorter term here? I know that we saw also recently this case involving state licensing boards and dental cleaners, and that shows again that even though it was, you know, an antitrust case in general, it shows the Supreme Court increasingly with an influence in health policy. Do you, Abby or Nick, have any, you know, sort of parting thoughts on the role of high principle, high con law, or the Supreme Court in affecting healthcare markets?
You know, I think, and this is a theory that I'm working on for a sort of broader notion of the role of the court in a regulatory state that I've been pursuing for a long time now and hope to have published fairly soon. But I have this idea that the court is not the best institution to be involved here, and that a lot of the doctrines that it's developed over time, including Chevron, are meant to limit the influence of non-political, non-expert decision makers like the nine justices of the court in the day-to-day questions of policy that have become so common in the federal regulatory state. This Supreme Court doesn't seem to be particularly interested in standing by a lot of those deferential doctrines that have been there for a while to try to limit the influence of the court, and they have been increasing their reach. And in health policy, it's so keenly felt because it's an area that requires so much specialized knowledge and expertise. You know, we talk about, is health law the law of the horse? And I keep wanting to say, yes, it's the law of the horse, bite me. You need to know something about healthcare in order to regulate it well. And the court doesn't really know that much about healthcare, so it is not going to do a great job of regulating it. So the more that we can try to push the court in the direction of limiting its own role and deferring to the political branches, I think the better the outcomes are going to be for healthcare regulation.
This was The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Abigail Moncrief from BU. She is at Amoncrief, which is Amoncrieff on Twitter. And Abby, if Justice Kennedy follows your argument, you must promise to return in June for a podcast that we will then be entitling The Law Professor Who Saved Obamacare.
I would be happy to. Thanks so much for having me.
We post our show notes at twill.com. That's TWIHL.com. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry. That's NicolasTerry on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be found?
Yes, I can be found at Frank Pasquale on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us. Have a legally interesting but healthy week.